So I thought I talked a bit ahead with Maite, and she told me that. Did they change it?
No.
It was always like. So as far as I understand, during your course, you mostly focused on 3D gravity. So I thought to first, in the first 5 minutes maybe, I speak a bit about the four-dimensional case, the history, and how loop quantum gravity started, and then speak about applications, namely applications to cosmology. And how to understand the evolution of a quantum universe in the symmetry reduced framework. So, the first part of the talk is loop quantum gravity in four dimensions. And a bit of history and outlook. So the entire approach started in the 1980s, when it was realized by Ashteker that there is a description of the phase space of general relativity in terms of gauge covariant variables, namely variables that transform as variables for a non-abelian gauge theory, namely where the underlying gauge group is the Lorentz group. In fact, what he could demonstrate is that there's a phase space where the basic phase space variables for gravity are SL2C complex gauge connection, and its conjugate momentum, which is a SL2C Lie algebra valued vector density, which are canonically conjugate. And the remarkable observation was that if we express general relativity in terms of these variables, the constraints of the theory assume a remarkable simple form, namely they are all polynomials in the elementary fields. Namely, we have the Gauss constraint, which says that non-abelian divergence of the Young-Mills gravity electric field vanishes. Then we have the vector constraint that generates three-dimensional spatial diffeomorphisms on the spatial hypersurface. And the scalar constraint that generates refoliations of your foliation of space-time. So these are all integrals over 3D space, because working in the Hamiltonian formalism, we work in a 3 plus 1 split. And the remarkable observation is that all these constraints are polynomials in the fundamental fields, where F is the curvature, the magnetic field, so to say, associated to the Young-Mills gauge connection. And now the idea was to that since these are structurally simple variables on phase space, to quantize them using tools and techniques from non-abelian gauge theories. The difficulty in this approach was that the underlying gauge group is non-compact and the variables are complex. In fact, the connection, if we express it in terms of geometrical variables, splits into a real and imaginary part, where the real part is the intrinsic SU2 spin connection on the spatial hypersurface and K is the extrinsic curvature, while of how you embed your 3D hypersurface into spacetime, and the electric field is the densitized triad. And you will have seen that for 3D gravity, a very similar structure appears as in four dimensions, the difference being that now we have not a topological theory, but two propagating degrees of freedom per point once we divide by the phase space by these constraints. Now, the difficulty with this approach was that these variables are complex. And working with complex variables on the resulting Hilbert space, once you do go through a similar spin network quantization as in 3D, that the resulting reality conditions are very hard to impose. What was then realized is that already at the classical level, one can do something like an internal Wick rotation, where instead of working with complex variables, we can go to real-valued variables. And E and the electric field is unchanged. And the point is that this shift from the complex variables to the real variables is a canonical transformation on phase space. So the only thing that happens at the level of the Poisson commutation relations is that now the imaginary unit is replaced by a new parameter which labels this canonical transformation that depends on gamma, which is the immersive parameter, in a parametric way. And then the point is that the underlying constraints can still all be expressed in terms of these now real variables. And one can then now use methods from lattice QCD related approaches to quantize this phase space and impose the constraints at the quantum level. Now, instead of going outlining the quantization using these variables, let us now jump right into an application, namely how to quantize the theory at the symmetry reduced level in order to do cosmology. So now we have the basic setup of our variables. Now we have to find a way to So now the second point is symmetry reduction. The phase space that I've introduced in here describes infinitely many degrees of freedom. It's a field theory. But instead of quantizing now the field theory, I want to quantize the theory at the symmetry reduced level, which means that I impose an additional constraint, namely that the fields carry are homogeneous and isotropic. Now, if you impose this at the level of your line elements, you find that your metric can be generally written in the following form, where A is the scale factor, N is an is the Laplace function, which is the analog of the smearing function appearing in the at the field theoretical level in the Hamiltonian constraint, and d sigma is a fiducial a line element on space. And in the simplest case, namely in the case of a flat cosmology, this is just the metric on 3D space. And just as we impose homogeneity and isotropy at the level of the metric, we can also imply these constraints at the level of our configuration variables. And in that case, we find that the connection just like the metric can only be by symmetry, that by our symmetry requirements, the metric on the spatial slice can only be proportional to the flat metric in Minkowski space. Similarly, by symmetry, the connection coefficients and the conjugate momentum can only be proportional to the fiducial structures that exist on our hypersurface, which are these differential forms. So the connection is proportional, where C and P are functions of time, to a flat connection reference connection on space. And similarly, the conjugate momentum, which is the electric field, is proportional to a fixed undynamical electric field on the spatial hypersurface. And now the question is, what do the commutation relations for the variables in the field theory imply for the commutation relations of P and C? Well, to figure this out, we look at the symplectic potential, which is the integral of E contracted over A, integrated delta A, times this prefactor, which determines the Poisson brackets. And if we insert this, we get P delta C over 8 pi gamma G integral of D3x DAI DXIA. Now this contraction is just a number, it's 3, and the integral over D3x. Now, this gives a fixed number that depends. So this is the volume of our spatial slice with respect to the coordinate system that we have chosen. Now, for our flat cosmology, this generally diverges. But if you restrict our analysis to a fixed box, essentially, with some fixed coordinate length, then we can just absorb this into the definition of our variables, and we find for the Poisson brackets at the symmetry reduced level simply 8 pi gamma g over 3. Right. And now the question is, now we have a very simple phase space that is defined by these Poisson brackets. What do we now know about the constraints? So we have to still impose the constraints to our theory. Now, you know that if you impose that your geometry is homogeneous and isotropic in space, and you have no matter, the only solution to your field equations is just flat space. So to have some interesting dynamics, you have to add on top of your fundamental variables some additional degrees of freedom that introduce some non-trivial dynamics. And the simplest choice for doing so is to just couple a matter field. So instead of working with just pure gravity, we now consider the theory in the presence of of additional matter degrees of freedom. So we have to speak about the now at the Hamilton at the Lagrangian level. This is straightforward. We just add the action for instance, a free massless scalar field. But what happens at the then at the Hamiltonian level is that just like the action, now that we have new additional matter degrees of freedom, this will show up in the constraints. Since these fields are uncharged under the, so they do not transform under the Lorentz symmetry, the Gauss constraint, for instance, is just the same as it was before, but the vector constraint now acquires additional terms that tell us how the fundamental fields of our theory now couple under diffeomorphisms. And what we find is simply this additional term, where pi is the momentum conjugate to the value of the matter field. But now, just as we do a symmetry reduction at the level of the gravitational degrees of freedom, we also need to do a symmetry reduction at the level of the matter degrees of freedom. So we impose that phi, the matter field, is just constant in space. And similarly, its momentum, which is a density, is just proportional to a number times the fiducial density, d3x. And again, assuming that the volume, the fiducial volume of our box with respect to these coordinates is just 1, then we find that the additional Poisson brackets for our meta degrees of freedom, namely that pi and phi are canonically conjugate variables. So now we have the structure of our phase space. Now we have to impose the constraints on that phase space. What turns out is that these two constraints are automatically satisfied. Why is that so? Well, phi is constant in space, so its gradient vanishes. And similarly, one finds that the curvature of the connection is, in fact, now easy to compute. So we take our formula for the field strength, and insert our parameterization. And what you then immediately see is that any gradients, so the first term, the gradient term, vanishes because C is not a function of space. It only is a function of time. So the only contribution comes from the second term. So we get a term C squared epsilon ILM DXLA DXMB. And now it's, and on the other hand, E, remember EIA is just P D3X DIA. And if you now contract these indices as they appear in the expression for the vector constraint, you immediately see that you get one contraction where you take the trace over two repeated indices, simply using dx, the duality between the one forms and the vectors, the coordinate vectors, delta Li. So using this, using that the two bases are dual to each other, you will find that this term vanishes, and this one vanishes as well because phi is constant in space. So the vector constraint is already solved by our choice of by our symmetry requirements, and the same is true for the Gauss constraint, which is already solved at the classical level. The only expression we are left with is the scalar constraint, where now n is some, again by symmetry, by our symmetry requirements, is just constant. So we will get a term. So E appears quadratic. The only dynamical ingredient, the only dynamical quantity in the electric field is P. In the field strength, on the other hand, the only dynamical quantity is C squared. So what we will find is that the gravitational part of the constraint in the symmetry reduced theory will be proportional to PC squared. Still, we are interested in the coupled theory, where we have both matter and geometry excited. Now, you know what is the Hamiltonian for a matter field. It's just pi squared plus d3 v squared hab nabla a phi nabla b phi. So this will be the contribution to the Hamiltonian coming from matter. And what you see here is that, again, by our symmetry requirement, all gradient terms vanish. And we will find that this is proportional to pi squared. So the constraint that we will finally end up with is that pi squared is proportional to pc squared. And now the idea is to quantize this theory, this constraint, using the commutation relations for these variables. However, we also want to remember where this theory comes from, namely from loop quantum gravity. And what is now often done is a change of variables. And why is that so? Well, P is parametrizes the electric field, which has dimensions of area. But if we, in cosmology, it's often more useful to work with, use the volume of the universe as your basic variable. And we also know from loop quantum gravity, from the full theory, that volume has a certain spectrum, is in fact quantized. And we want to use this ingredient to find a realization of this constraint. So that's the only component left from the Hamiltonian constraint at the quantum level. And therefore, it's useful to go to different variables, namely variables that are related to the volume, which is like P to the 3/2. So P has dimensions of area, V will have dimensions of volume. And the corresponding canonical conjugate variable is the square root of C. And what you then find is that that the constraint still assumes essentially the same form. In fact, it is still up to some prefactors BV squared. Sorry. So that cannot be. So there is P just bear with me. No, I need C. Yeah. And so now what is the strategy? The strategy is to now quantize these variables using an input from loop quantum gravity. And the input is very simple, namely that in the theory, in LQG, geometry is quantized. At the symmetry reduced level, this suggests that we should consider states of the following form, where volume again is quantized. But this is at odds with our commutation relations from the symmetry reduced level, because using a standard Schrödinger quantization, we would represent V as a multiplication operator, while B is represented as a derivative. But if volume is now quantized, we cannot represent B as a derivative, because volume is now quantized. So that doesn't work. What works, so one way out of this, which is motivated by the usage of holonomies and fluxes, which are essentially exponentials of the connection is to work with different variables where we essentially exponentiate B, where we compactify the conjugate momentum, because once the momentum variable is compactified, its conjugate variable, which is the volume, will have a discrete spectrum. And one way to do this is to introduce harmonic oscillators, to define A as square root of V e to the minus I lambda B, and A dagger as square root of V e to the plus I lambda B, where lambda is a fixed constant, a fixed parameter. And then it's easy to see that using these commutation relations, A and A dagger will satisfy the commutation relations of the harmonic oscillator. And now the question is, using these variables, how can we write down a candidate for our constraint? Well, take A minus A squared minus A dagger squared, for instance, a squeeze operator. At the level of the classical theory, this is V times minus V sine lambda B. So if we divide this by lambda and assume that lambda is small, this is just minus VB. So we now have a candidate for our constraint that takes into account one single input from the full theory, namely that geometry is quantized. Where instead of now quantizing this constraint, we quantize a slightly modified constraint that takes into account the fundamental discreteness of volume that we find in the full theory. And we now have that pi squared is should be A squared minus A dagger squared over lambda squared. And now we can quantize this by saying that pi gets replaced by h bar over I d over d phi, and A dagger act like harmonic oscillator, act like harmonic oscillators on the gravitational eigenstates. In addition to that, what is also often done is to view phi, and I will close soon, as a clock. And with respect to which our gravitational degrees of freedom evolve. And then what has been a constraint in the gravitational theory can now be viewed as an evolution equation in the canonical momentum for the matter field. Namely, we now take the square root of this equation. So pi is plus minus a squared minus a dagger squared over lambda, with some prefactors that involve Newton's constant and so on. And what you then find is that a Schrödinger-like equation for now the single gravitational degree of freedom which is left, which is the volume of the universe, the volume of your box, because we had to restrict ourselves to configurations where the volume is finite. And then what you get is a very simple Schrödinger equation, a squared minus a dagger squared divided by lambda psi. And now, now you can ask, how does this dynamics differ from the classical theory? For instance, you can look at sharply peaked states that are semi-classical at late times, where the matter field plays now the role of time. And you can look at the expectation value of the volume operator, which is just the Heisenberg evolution of the volume operator that is now just counting the quanta in your state. And what you then find is that a classical solution shows exponential growth. Now I remember the right factor. But in quantum theory, you find a different behavior. Notice that the Big Bang is at phi goes to minus infinity, at which point the volume goes to zero. And if you look at this, in fact, pi is a conserved quantity. So if p goes to zero, the volume goes to zero, c goes to infinity, so curvature diverges. So this is where the singularity is. And what you find is that now with this modified dynamics that is inherited by this simple argument from the full theory, you get a modification. Namely, what essentially happens is that this exponential growth is replaced by a hyperbolic cosine. So in quantum theory, expectation values deviate from the classical theory at small volumes. In fact, that is, I should be more precise at that point. For a long time, in the initial version of the theory, it was thought that these deviations from the classical theory happen when the volume is of the order of the Planck length, the Planck volume. But it turns out that that was related to, that led to serious problems. And in fact, it was related to using somehow the wrong variables, starting out this argument with these variables instead of those that have a more physical interpretation in terms of volume and its canonical momentum, which is the Hubble factor, in fact. And what you then find is that this bounce does not happen at small volume, when volume is of the order of the Planck volume, but when the energy density of matter, which is this expression, is of the order of the Planck density. And then the universe bounces back and expands again. So quantum effects in the very early universe resolve the singularity. Now this is a toy model, but a toy model that just uses one ingredient of the full theory, namely that volume is discrete. The construction can be summarized as follows. Assume that volume is discrete. How would you then represent the Hamiltonian constraint in the quantum theory? It cannot be just that, because starting from this version of the Hamiltonian constraint and using a standard Schrödinger quantization, you would not find a discrete spectrum of volume. So something else has to go on, namely the conjugate variable needs to be compactified, in which case it is natural to work with these harmonic oscillators where the conjugate variable is compactified, and then you can approximate the Hamiltonian constraint in terms of A and A dagger by this operator, where A squared minus A dagger squared is a squeeze operator, and you can very simply solve the dynamics and you find this behavior. Thanks.
So since we are a bit over time, let's move to Al, and if you have questions, maybe you can stay around.
Yes.
Sorry for being over.
Hello. My name is Hal Haggard. I am a professor at Bard College, south of here a little ways, just north of New York City. I am aware of the phenomena that the second lecturer always experiences time dilation. I knew this was coming. So I actually put together a very qualitative conceptual introduction to some of the things that are happening in black holes. I'm not going to try and pass any technical details to you. A lot of what I'm saying has technical details behind it. So I'm here till Friday. Really, I'm here over the weekend. So if you want to come visit me, I'm in 353, just around the corner, and you can come chat with me about any of it. Since it's a pretty small group, could I get people's names just really quickly? I know Maite and Wolfgang and David and Chao Min, but maybe
Braden.
Aisha,
Katie,
Ramiro,
Danilo,
Axel.
Say it again.
Axel.
Peter.
George.
Jacob.
Yeah.
Great. So nice to meet you all. So everything I'm going to say actually has nothing specifically to do with loop quantum gravity. It's kind of the framing of the question of why do we care about black holes in quantum gravity, period. Mostly I want to pose questions. Mostly I want to ask you, why is this a good laboratory for quantum gravity? And then why we think about these things specifically in loop quantum gravity, I can tell you on the fly. So black holes are an incredible laboratory for a number of reasons. So when a star runs out of its nuclear fuel, it collapses, right? And the initial dynamics there is just a gravitational collapse. We could even treat it in a Newtonian fashion. But as the star continues to collapse, eventually it passes its own Schwarzschild radius and strong gravity effects start to become relevant. So we know that even in this context, GR is relevant because you can do things like gravity probe B. Has everybody heard of this experiment? They took a beautiful set of gyroscopes that were extremely precisely machined spheres, put them on a satellite and set them spinning. This gives you a direction in space-time. And then they looked for rotating frame effects, for frame dragging, classical general relativistic frame dragging as they had the satellite orbit the sun. So we know GR effects are relevant already at the scale of solar mass stars and things like this. And the interesting thing is that as the matter passes its own Schwarzschild radius, we fully expect that general relativity continues to be relevant, right? There's no singularity. There's nothing strange that's happening at that radius. And in part, this is because the curvature scale is very mild. If you have a big enough star, or if you have a big enough collection of matter, the Schwarzschild radius is actually a very low curvature surface. So for example, for Sagittarius A star, this is the supermassive black hole at the center of our own galaxy. Sagittarius A star has a mass of about 4 million solar masses. Anybody know the Schwarzschild radius for a solar mass black hole? Turns out it's about 3 kilometers. So 2GM solar over C squared is about 3 kilometers. So the curvature scale here, we often use the Kretschmann scalar. Kretschmann scalar is necessary because what's wrong with using the Ricci scalar to characterize the curvature scale of a black hole?
Zero for it.
Yeah, it's a vacuum solution, right? So it's zero, so we use the Kretschmann scalar. So this is what I mean by the Kretschmann scalar. And it works out to be about 12 times the Schwarzschild radius squared, c to the fourth over r to the sixth. So this is for a Schwarzschild black hole. And if we evaluate that at the Schwarzschild radius, then what do we get? We get some numerical factors, which I don't care about, over R Schwarzschild to the fourth, or the Kretschmann scalar goes like 1 over the Schwarzschild radius squared. So the Schwarzschild radius is a good estimate of the invariant curvature scale of the horizon. And so putting these numbers together, we just said that a solar mass black hole is about 3 kilometers. That means the Schwarzschild radius of Sag A star is going to be about 12 million kilometers, right? And so the curvature scale we're talking about is about 1 over 12 million kilometers squared. So what's the curvature scale of the Earth? Earth is about 6,000 kilometers in radius. So the curvature scale is 1 over that squared. So the curvature scale of Sag A star's horizon is much, much smaller than the curvature scale of Earth. So we don't expect there's anything crazy that's happening at the horizon of Sag A star. No? So this means that we should continue to follow general relativity within the horizon. It seems there's no special relativity, no special effects happening at the horizon. So what if we into the black hole? Well, you all know what happens. The trouble is that we get a singularity eventually. So the matter continues to collapse. And the full expectation of, I think, everybody in the quantum gravity community is that you can no longer neglect quantum mechanical effects at some point. So this is one of the reasons that black holes are such a compelling laboratory for thinking about quantum gravity. The interior has got to be strong gravitational and quantum mechanical. So you've probably thought about this already, but Maite, I should stop around quarter after, is that right?
You can ask me to that if you can go over.
I don't want to go over. You've got things to do. I'll go at most 2 or 3 minutes over. So one of the places that we really expect quantum gravity to be strongly relevant is on the interior. But the natural question at this point, I think the one that everybody asks is, who cares? This is a causally disconnected region. There's no empirical result. In fact, I often am trying to discourage people in popular audiences from asking me about the interior of a black hole, because there's nothing I can say about it empirically. So the natural question is, who cares? And I think there is a reason to care, which is that if we think that quantum gravity does resolve this singularity, then it changes the global structure of space-time. So a quantum gravity resolution and this global structure is actually really important for all kinds of interesting conclusions about black holes. So it's interesting for whether there is some empirical signature of quantum gravity resolution. It's interesting for whether you believe in ADS-CFT holography type of ideas. Holography changes a lot if you change the global structure of your space-time. And in fact, I think sometimes the discussion of holography gets caught up because people forget that they've made a mathematical idealization by working with a completely mathematically continued space-time, where you have regions that aren't actually necessarily going to be available. So I think these global issues actually matter a lot, and it's an important thing for you to latch onto early. How do I think about the global structure? What is it going to do? So you all know the answer for the first round of how do I think about this. It's Penrose diagrams. So let's take the Minkowski space Penrose diagram. So Penrose diagram is just an encapsulation of our favorite space-time diagrams, where we are able to look at all kinds of causal structure of Minkowski space. So what we go to is a compactification of this. So we use a series of coordinate transformations that preserve the propagation of light. So in the Penrose diagram, light continues to propagate at 45 degrees. So our light cones still look like this, but we've captured the full global structure. So here's the infinite past, I minus, infinite future, spatial infinity. And then the cool thing about these diagrams is they give us access to the light-like infinities. So we can think about what happens to light rays all the way to the infinite past of the light ray and its infinite future. So the R equals zero surface is here. And if I wanted to draw a constant R surface, it would look like this. So that would be an example of a constant R surface. And light rays, well, you could think of a sphere of light that's collapsing from infinity, comes all the way to a focus, and then starts re-expanding. That re-expansion we draw on this diagram is a sort of bouncing, a mirror-like bouncing off of R equals zero. So this is how we would view the causal structure of Minkowski. So a major theme in quantum gravity, then, is whether quantum gravity resolves the central singularity of a black hole. So here would be a black hole diagram. We draw the singularity as a wiggly line. The event horizon at R equals 2m is this line. It is indeed a null surface, so it makes sense that it's a 45 degree line on this diagram. And the central singularity is here. So this is kind of a fine diagram. It's one we think about a lot. But it has some features that, here, if we had a collapsing star, it's what the star would look like. It has some features that you have to really be careful about and think through. So where is high curvature in this diagram? High curvature is in a surface that surrounds this central singularity, right? That's where we think quantum gravity should be relevant. Where is late times in this diagram? If I have a physical observer that never falls into the black hole, well, they go all the way up to here. So late times is this point on the diagram at the top here. And notice that there's something very strange about the compactification. It brings the high curvature region around the central singularity in the diagram, it brings it close to late times. And you have to really view these kinds of points on this diagram with great suspicion. Because late times shouldn't be anything odd, and yet it seems to be very close to a region of high curvature. And so I want you to start to view some points on space-time diagrams with great suspicion, and try to start to think about what does that mean, what's going on there. That point has actually been the central focus of black hole research for 30 years. In the following way, 50 years, it's crazy. Here's a Hawking evaporating black hole. The diagram that's most often drawn is one like this, where you allow now the horizon to start emitting light-like particles. So it starts to emit mass and energy. Over the evolution of the black hole, that mass and energy eventually causes the black hole to completely evaporate. And so then after that point, well, it's flat space-time again. All the energy has been radiated out. And so we have a Minkowski space-like causal structure after that point. But again, this point is extremely unclear what's exactly happening there physically. Okay. So people have worried about this a lot. And the paradigm that's come up in quantum gravity, and it was called a paradigm in the paper that proposed this, is that we should really consider a space-time with the same causal structure as Minkowski space, same global structure. And what we should think about is a central singularity that isn't really a singularity. It's covered by a high curvature region. So this is both in the past of the singularity and to its future. And so this singularity, we shouldn't really draw it in the diagram. We should really draw some sort of hashed region, which is where quantum gravity applies. This paradigm is interesting because you can have Hawking radiation to the past of the central singularity, but you can also have some sort of quantum gravity evolution to the future. And you avoid lots of problems that arise in this context. So the information problem is often posed in this context. Say I take some Cauchy slice of this space-time, some slice on which I could specify initial data and ask how does it evolve. The question of information loss becomes very strong here. There's no causal way for any portion of this Cauchy slice that's inside the black hole to give information back out. And the Hawking radiation has been largely shown not to give enough information out to recover what you would have to specify on this in a reasonable time frame. And so you have a question of, do black holes just eat information? So in this paradigm, information can be preserved, but you do have to exit outside the other side of a quantum gravity region. So a lot of work within black holes has been about finding concrete models of this. There's a huge variety of opinions and interesting ideas. I'll give you a very idiosyncratic one that just has to do with research I've done. But don't take it any more seriously than other things that are out there. The idea that I've worked on a lot is, well, this looks very interesting from a time reversal symmetry perspective. And so perhaps we can think of this as a gluing of a black hole in the past to a white hole in the future. So let me say two words about what a white hole is, and then I'll stop. So the Kruskal space-time diagram you've probably done. So this is the complete geodesic extension of Schwarzschild. So it has a black hole region in the future, but it has this region in the past that we rarely talk about. This is a white hole. So it's just the time reversal of a black hole. If you imagine taking a movie of a black hole, things would fall into the black hole over time. If you ran that movie, but things would never come out, right, of the black hole. If you ran that movie in reverse, things would come out of a white hole region, but never go into it, right? So these two surfaces here act like event horizons of the reverse nature. Things come out of these horizons, but never enter them. So the remarkable thing about this, and it's been known since the Kruskal solution was found, is that white holes are solutions to general relativity. They're classical, perfectly well-behaved solutions. So why do you never hear about them? Why do people kind of treat them almost like they're science fiction? Well, it's because we can't think of any initial data, any Cauchy data that we could specify that would evolve into a white hole, right? So they're kind of dynamically forbidden, right? What's the initial data that I make in order to form a white hole? But quantum mechanics give you a really interesting opportunity, which is that if something's allowed quantum mechanically, then it happens, right? All kinematically allowed solutions are dynamically accessible via tunneling, right? So the question shifts. It shifts from a question of, is this an allowed solution, to a question of what is the amplitude for accessing that solution. So this has led to an interesting line of research that I've worked a little with Maite on and others. What is the amplitude? For a black hole to tunnel into a white hole. Notice this is a weird kind of tunneling that you've probably never discussed. It's tunneling of geometry, not of matter, right? We're actually imagining the gravitational field changes from one classical solution to another. So this is an interesting line of research, I think, for black holes. It gives, in particular, a way to realize this paradigm. There are other ways within loop quantum gravity. There have been efforts to do this with spin networks and spin foams. And so I think there's plenty of interesting things to do in this area. So I'll stop there. There was one more thing I was really tempted to tell you about. So if you want to come visit me, I didn't say anything about black hole entropy, but a lot of people here at this institute study black hole entropy, and they say, well, maybe black hole entropy is got to do with soft modes or edge modes or boundary effects. These are all things that people consider. And I found this very implausible for a long time. And there's an order of magnitude estimate that I did recently that I think makes it much more plausible and interesting. My concern was maybe black hole entropy, the states of a black hole, quantum states, it actually takes a lot of energy, like Planckian style energies, to go from one black hole state to another. So there's a really fun estimate that I encourage you to try and come up with, which is the level spacing. All you take is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And what's the level spacing of the quantum mechanical states of a black hole? And the answer is really striking. It's actually low energy. It's a low energy spacing. So it's made all of these soft mode ideas much more plausible to me and much more interesting. So that's another thing for you to play with and think about. Thank you. Sorry to kind of run.
Yeah, you want one?
I'm happy to take questions, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So this this tunnel amplitude, it highly depends on the size of the black hole, right?
Yes.
So it's more possible for like really teeny tiny black holes, right?
Yes.
So it would be the end stage of a Hawking radiation.
That's right.
Black hole. Okay.
That's right. So there's some efforts in the literature. So do you know the lifetime of a black hole, the Hawking lifetime?
It's a long time.
Yeah, that's what's
but
so.
It's really short when they're tiny.
That's right. So it goes as m cubed.
Yeah.
So for a solar mass black hole, this is 10 to the 75 seconds. This is for m solar. So anybody know the age of the universe in seconds? The age of the universe is about 10 to the 17 seconds. Yes. So it's 14 billion years, and then a year is about pi times 10 to the 7 seconds, right? So you can get 10 to the 17 seconds. So the lifetime of a black hole is absurd, really absurd, right? 10 to the 50 ages of the universe. And the 60 ages of the universe. So this is a massive problem for phenomenology of black holes, right? Particularly of quantum black holes. The Hawking effect is never going to give us an observable thing because solar mass black holes just live way too long. So there's a hope for a while, well, maybe there were primordial black holes, and primordial black holes were small enough mass that we could observe them evaporating now. But it seems that even primordial black holes don't tend to be in the light enough mass range. So there's a real puzzle out there about how do you make any of this phenomenologically accessible. And it's very active. And gravitational waves are really compelling. It's partly why I think turning towards the entropy and thinking about the entropy is such an interesting way to go. Because this global structure, while I think it's really insignificant, and I think it's significant conceptually, right? Because I think you can run into all kinds of problems with holography type arguments unless you understand what the global structure of your spacetime is. It's not really phenomenologically accessible, it seems. So we have to keep working. We have to look for other signatures of these effects.
Sorry. So if really the quantum gravity resolves the central singularity, should we still be worried about naked singularities?
So here's my favorite way to get at it. I would say no. My favorite way to get at this is another puzzle, and maybe I'll just do it like the black hole entropy. I'll just cast it as a puzzle for you. Everybody knows Kruskal. Does anyone know the causal structure of Kerr? In particular, I'm curious about the singularities. You know how the singularities look in Kerr?
Like this?
Yeah, they're vertical, right? So it's famously the Kruskal singularity is space-like, right? But the Kerr singularities are time-like. So here's my way of, that I like to ask this question. So here, let me try and sketch the Kerr extension. If you want the full extension, you can repeat this diagram as many times as you want, right? But here's the singularities. And the thing that I think is so interesting about them is that they're time-like, right? So are you telling me that physically the really reasonable thing is I start with a black hole that has no rotation, and I rotate it just a tiny bit, and suddenly I go from something that has space-like singularities to something that has time-like singularities? Do I really think that that's the physical evolution? My answer would be no, that makes no sense at all. You have to start to take quantum gravity into account much earlier than the singularity. So I don't think naked singularities is the issue. It's an issue of high curvatures, right? I have a paper about this puzzle if you want to think about it more.
Okay, I think we need to conclude.
Yeah.
So thanks again for to Wolfgang and Hal.